Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really incredible founder, you know, a founder that he's right now riding a rocket ship. You know, we're going to be talking about it in detail. You know, there's going to be great stuff there we're going to be touching on during the show today. We're going to be talking about why he got himself perfectly situated to be able to ride this rocket ship, how he thinks about raising money. I mean, in their case, they've raised over $200 million. So really remarkable, especially given the times that we are in. And they just recently announced their last day raise, which was 200. And then also bringing a differentiation, you know, when it comes to a segment, you know, where there is like massive players that are already operating. And so, again, super inspiring conversation. So brace yourself for it. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, John Clendenning. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Alejandro. Thank you.
So originally born in Alabama. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Early days, Alabama. And then after a year there, then Florida on the beach. I just remember being super hot, not wearing shoes very much. And weekends spent kind of roaming around what today is Destin, Florida. It was a nice place to start and great place to go on vacation after my dad moved the family up to Wisconsin.
So the whole thing about business, you know, I mean, obviously you went to Northwestern, you also did your MBA. I mean, this love for the business world, where does that thing come from?
You know, I was one of those people that thought to themselves in high school and early college that I wanted a career in business before I even knew what it was. My dad was a lawyer, went to social work, mom stayed at home at that time, pretty common. But I was fascinated by brands. I was fascinated by the stock market. I played a stock market game when I was in junior high school, now middle school, I guess. And I was just thinking, like, what an amazing world that must be to be a part of a big company that's growing. And then that stock market element as well. When I was at Northwestern, which I chose on the basis of really wanting the underpinnings of a true classical education, I started to get the itch to like really jump into business in a serious way. Led me to consulting after that. But at that time, right, I thought it was like super cool to be able to study the classics, get in touch with language, took Spanish for a couple of years, really broadened my horizons from my upbringing in the South and then in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But the inspiration for business like took root when I was at Northwestern. I was part of a small group called the College of Commerce and Industry, where speakers come in and talk about what's it like to lead, what's it like to innovate. But you've got the ability to influence lots and lots of people, not just consumers, but also people that are in the company. And that aspect of leadership really began to fascinate me.
So then in your case, I mean, you've jumped quite a bit, you know, when it comes to companies, you know, and segments too. I guess, you know, you did quite a bit the consulting, consumer, then banking, you know, obviously you did it on large corporations, smaller corporations. I guess the first thing is during your time in consulting, what do you think you got about problem solving? How do you think that has helped you into maybe thinking about big problems, breaking them down into small problems and tackling them? I mean, what kind of strategy did that experience give you into thinking about problem solving?
I think the main thing it gave me was an ability to go into any type of situation, different businesses, different projects and that sort of thing, and have the confidence that you'll be able to size it up. You'll be able to jump in, put some deep thought into what will be necessary to get up the learning curve rapidly, learn about that new business really rapidly. But that confidence and the framework around that was really useful for me. And it's that self-confidence element I want to emphasize. Until you've done it a couple of times, and I've been like not in an undergrad B school, and in consulting, as you know, right, they just sort of drop you in and like, here's your stuff to go do. But developing the right toolkit to really size up a business deeply in terms of its people, in terms of its product set or services set, in terms of its economics. It's sort of amazing as a side note how few people sometimes in a company don't know how the company makes money, don't know how the consumers regard the company, don't know what is coming around the corner that might disrupt that company. And consulting allowed me to, I think you're right in calling it problem solving, by the way. much more that than true, like, big picture strategy. But it gave me the confidence that I could go into anything and put my mind to it in the right way, tap into the people of the company the right way, and get up to speed quickly. And that also enabled me to feel okay changing companies in the early part of the career pretty rapidly as well, that I could go in and make an impact relatively quickly.
I mean, then you went to the consumer side, you know, and quite interesting that you decided to work for the two biggest players, biggest competitors that one can think of, whether it's a PepsiCo or Coca-Cola. But yeah. I guess the, unbelievable. Now, I guess this experience too gave you the exposure to direct marketing. So how was that for you?
It was crucial for me to go into packaged goods. And as you mentioned, the two big competitors, Pepsi and Coke. And I learned so much around the idea that you've got to spend a lot of your time, like a dominant part of your time, thinking about the consumer and what do they regard as unmet needs. And on top of that, like, dig really, really deep for differentiation. Now, I'm in a business today where I think differentiation gaps are huge. But in packaged goods, right, they're pretty narrow. In reality, right, what's the difference between a Coke and a Pepsi? Well, if you're a big fan, you may see some, but most don't. And yet the marketing teams or the brand teams or the CEO in companies like that are spending so much time for the smallest of edges, but all grounded in the idea that if we know the consumer more deeply than the other player, we can find a way to win. Also super sharp at segmentation, all of which these comments and concepts, by the way, I think are largely lost on financial services firms. But really developed a sharp edge and an orientation toward differentiation built on understanding unmet need across a segment of consumers as a way to get sort of deeper and deeper and closer to what could be better for that consumer. Also learned a lot about leadership, just worked for some awesome people there. And the way I got to Coke, by the way, from Pepsi was I followed the one executive that Coca-Cola had ever at that time recruited from PepsiCo. The businesses don't like each other. The rivalry is massively strong, but they had the insight at Coke to bring over this guy who I was working for at Frito-Lay, and I was the one person he brought with him. So it was pretty cool to be able to see the differences between the two companies.
So then you went into startups. You know, that's quite a interesting segue. You know, you go from like massive companies to startups. So how did you enter the startup world?
Well, I'd actually been in a bank for a little while, and it was one of my worst decisions I've ever made, not having done my diligence on what the culture would be like there. But it was an opportunity to, you know, do some data-driven marketing versus mass at like a packaged goods company. Long story short, a group of us decided we'd start our own business and spend some time on the weekends. This is like 1998, by the way, so e-commerce is beginning to explode. It's looking like if you don't jump into the new economy, you're going to be a dinosaur. And, you know, I was 35 or 36 or whatever at the time. And I was really feeling that way, that I needed to find a way into the new economy. And so I had some great concepts. I ended up bouncing this off an individual who I had worked for at Frito-Lay. And he had just become CEO of this really, really cool company doing great things in that era, and brought me into his company with the team I'd been working with. So in my mind, what a great shortcut into a neat business that was already a couple rounds in to capital raise around, like, I don't know, like version 9 of the website. It was all about the website back then, of course. And sort of jumped into that. Had some great backers in Benchmark Capital, Austin Ventures. And I got in because I felt like I wanted to be part of that group because things were like quite unknown. Like, how are you going to win in e-commerce? There's no playbook for it. Like packaged goods, there's a playbook. Take the playbook, learn how to deploy it. There wasn't anything built yet at that time. It was a bit of a wild, wild west feeling, but a total shortfall in conviction on what are the things you need to do to truly win and build a sustainably profitable business, not known, not yet built out. And so the single biggest motivation I had was that. The second would have been to keep the career moving, keep vibrant by jumping into what looks to be the next wave. And that certainly was my experience, that both of those were true. That there's an opportunity to sort out how to compete as an e-commerce business. And on top of that, sort of like boost myself into a level of understanding I couldn't have gotten at some big traditional company. I had to go to a startup to get there.
So then in this case, I mean, you ended up after doing, you know, the startup life, you ended up going back at corporate. I mean, that's interesting because typically once you experience startups, it's tough to get, you know, back to corporate. So what triggered that?
So I think you're right, by the way. It's tough to leave, and it's been a lot of years since I was able to get back at it, about 15 years. And what I loved about startups, because I think it's salient to this, is I love the speed. I love the concept of time box decision making versus letting things like trundle on forever, which is common in big co. I really enjoyed leading high energy, like massively committed people to a person at these startups, massively committed. It's a lot easier to lead in that environment, right? Other than a place where maybe you got like half the people are engaged, the other half are not. At the same time, I had done two startups. One was Living.com in Austin. Couldn't raise capital, not a penny, after setting records for fundraising previous to that as the dot-com bust took root. Second one was a bit of a bunt single. The venture firm did okay. The rest was not so much. And so I wanted to get back to a bigger platform and reestablish my career. But I was also motivated by applying what I had learned in those 4 or 5 years in startups and seeing if I could bring that into a bigger platform. And that platform was Charles Schwab in 2004. But I was excited about taking that application into what was then a turnaround situation at Schwab. They also had not yet recovered from the dot-com bust, where trading velocity just collapsed and had shown no signs of improving. I'd done a couple of turnarounds. And crucial to this was some learning at the first startup in particular, and strong conviction that the winning client experience model is not an either or. It's not either electronic or human led. It's going to be what's the best way of mixing those together. We had done some experimentation at the startup in that vein as we struggled to grow volume, sales volume, and client volume, and I felt like Schwab would be an awesome place to apply some of those techniques in a firm that had already, right, they had sort of perfected online transacting. They had not perfected much more than that. I mean, great company, great brand, right? The brand, I'd say the brand in financial services, but there's a lot to go fix there. But that was the reason. I felt like I could apply some things, bigger platform in a turnaround situation. It was also a nice chance to get to San Francisco. It had already been on my wife and I mind to you know, somehow get to the Bay Area, and that's where they were headquartered at that time. So jumped into it, chance to turn around a business. And lo and behold, Chuck Schwab comes back in 6 months. It was an amazing set of circumstances that brought him back to the company. And what good fortune for me to be around a true business icon, an amazing leader in that space, a true innovator.
What do you think made him such an incredible leader? You know, I mean, having the opportunity to work, you know, alongside someone of that caliber, you know, I'm sure that they shaped you quite a bit.
Hugely. I'd say a couple things about Chuck. First is he believes in moving boldly, like doing a few things, big things in very bold fashion. It's what started the company, right? Deregulation hits commission pricing. Everybody raises their prices. That's Wall Street, right? You deregulate the price, people take it up. Chuck goes way down and applies just the right amount of insight to help people trade. So he's carried that philosophy with him over time. And I think that I'd link that then to work that that firm has done the last 10, 15 years, which I was part of in the early days, of moving the company into a new version, transforming. Like, what's the new big idea? Well, the big idea needed to be, we're going to become an advisory firm that taps into our lower cost structure, our multi-channel model, those sorts of things. But big picture one is moving boldly where other firms don't seem to be prepared to go. Second thing I'd say around Chuck that's made him an awesome leader is, man, that individual knows the power of a positive culture in driving business outcomes. It's, you know, Chuck's all about culture. There are people at that firm that'll never forget having met him and how Chuck instructed them on putting that client at the center. So for that company and for Chuck, let's keep it to Chuck, the idea of like being consumer centric is not on a piece of paper or a placard or whatever. It's how he's convinced himself, rightfully so, that if you really can do that and the culture's all around that, you can go through anything. You can go through like the hell that was the early 2000s. and you can go through a change process. It's a really big change process where people's roles are being upended because you've kept that that client, that customer at the center. And if there's a third thing about Chuck, I'd say that makes him an amazing leader is his raw business insight. There were many times where I had to go back to my office after Chuck would sort of impromptu call me in, and I could really think hard about what do I think Chuck was saying there, because he was like four or five steps ahead, and it was worth my time to really think about it, go back and talk it through. So that sort of, he's not a linear thinker, right? This is a discontinuous individual that like looks like way ahead. He predicted zero trading prices like way before Robinhood went there, as an example, and perhaps that company began staging for that long before they ultimately got there. But that sense of vision combined with culture and the confidence of moving boldly, I think those are all amazing and remarkable traits of Chuck. And I'd be lucky if I could emulate some of those to some degree, and I try to.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So in this case, you obviously learn a lot about operations, about management, leadership, and also turning things around. And in fact, you know, that's a kind of like what ended up being your next chapter with Blue Cora when you got recruited, you know, to do such thing. And funny enough, this was the most immediate kind of like segue, you know, for you getting going with Earned Wealth. So turning things around, that doesn't sound very, very easy, is it?
It's not. It does require all the tools in the toolkit. It also requires, right, some discernment around, is this situation fixable? What's like, why is this like fatally flawed business? Or is it some things that we've got some degrees of freedom to fix it? I think the main thing I've learned in those turnaround situations is, you know, a couple things. One is the power of resilience and being able to work through difficulty when things seem like they're getting darker. They tend to get a bit darker before the business is performing again. That's really served me well here in the last 3.5 years, given, you know, the fundraising environment and just how hard it is to start something from zero. And the second thing is, I think orienting the team around optimism, the idea that we can find a way to win. It may have been tough, it may be tough right now, but let's think about what that destination is, what is it going to feel like when we get there, and let's work together on a path to get there, and keeping keeping that optimistic element, not to say you're like misleading yourself or others, you have to be objective, but having an optimistic edge is necessary in those environments also has served me well. As noted in this sort of situation. But I've done those, and there's a framework for it. I would like go right back to the consumer and sort of refiguring out what's important to the consumer and taking the philosophy, which I learned at Freely, actually, which was sort of align the business model to the consumer and leave it to your, I mean, make sure it's your accountability to make it profitable. If you don't start with a consumer, you're screwed. If you try to like work your way into something that can work okay, but it's awesome economics for you, that's not going to be a real business. That won't last long. But it's going back to basics, typically in the turnaround situations.
So then at what point does the idea of earned wealth come knocking to you?
You know, it actually, I think though, like the route around earned wealth, you know, a truly differentiated approach to building and protecting wealth, in our case for doctors, it goes right back to that experience I briefly mentioned at a bank. So I'm at a big fat bank, and I had done poor diligence. I'm wondering, why am I here? I'm a cultural misfit, obviously. And I think they say the same thing about me, right? They didn't like me either. But you're realizing, oh my gosh, for the bank, a consumer is a set of digits in a flat file that's associated with their profitability today. There's no sense of like, what's the right thing to be done with the client? How do we help the client out? What's the value added we're uniquely providing? There's no sense of segmentation. Really, it's like the banks seem to exist for the benefit of the bank versus the other way around. And when I combine that with some of the other experiences right at Schwab, great investment company, you know, but pretty limited in like investment in a bank, not able to take into account taxes when advising. It's sort of an interesting thought where you're advising someone on maximizing their wealth, but you say, well, I'm not going to pay attention to your tax drag that I'm causing for you. It's like, wow, just this idea that a fragmented approach, as good as a company could be, but a fragmented approach wouldn't lead itself to the best results. And so I learned that at Schwab that you needed to combine things to be more successful. And then at Blucora, we began experimenting with, can you build technology, turns out you can, that can empower a channel of CPAs, but can you build the right software to capture tax alpha or tax advantage across the entire life of a consumer in ways that, you know, Robo had done it, but inside one account. And so, you know, we made a lot of progress there. We could generate massive value for our consumers. All that's to say, Alejandro, is that I sort of ladder up all those experiences together. And what we're doing has a link to all those sort of career stops. We're the, you know, we will be the sort of defining segment-driven financial services firm. So as I mentioned, right, we're focused on doctors. The reason for that is that their needs are unique. They're a real segment. We can build bespoke products and services because doctors have a unique career trajectory that impacts every aspect of their financial life. We do everything for the doctor. Whatever it takes to improve that financial situation, we're not there yet. I'm not going to oversell you, but our vision is to be able to work holistically with that physician, solving for every single need in their practice life, in their individual life. And then lastly, we're building and leveraging deep technology to essentially automate broad advice giving, advising on how do you optimize the sale of your practice. A lot of physicians and dentists are doing that. They have no idea what their practice is worth. One segment, do everything, really crush it for them, do everything, and leverage tech to make it reliable, predictable, and scalable.
So in this case, how are you guys making money? You know, for the people that are listening to get it, how do you guys make money here?
So our revenue model is essentially a percentage of assets model for personal wealth management, not dissimilar at all to a large registered investment advisor. The difference is we do everything for that client. So we're going to do taxes for the client. We're going to do insurance optimization for the client. On our roadmap is to do trust and estate planning, triggering when the wills need to get redone and that sort of thing. We optimize today for the balance sheet, like what should be your loan profile versus opportunities to invest, that sort of thing. So it's the difference is sort of that same basic fee, but we do a ton more. Then on the practice side, we do taxes and financial statement preparation. We do retirement planning all around de-stressing the doctor in that situation, optimizing their financial life as relates to their practice. Key thing here is, right, we're all about, can we increase the cash flow of that practice so that they can have more to invest in the markets or in alternative investments, let's say, so that over time they can double, triple, maybe even more their net worth at retirement.
You guys have also raised quite a bit of money. You know, I know that the last round was announced very recently, you know, at a time where it's not as easy to raise money, but you guys made it seem easy, you know, with the amount that you raised. So how much capital have you guys raised to date, and what has been the motions there of going from one cycle to the next?
Yeah. So total, we've raised about $225 million. We were backed at the seed stage by a design studio, Juxtapose, A-Round, led by Hudson Structured, about a year and a half ago. And then Summit and Silversmith, growth equity firms, have been our, you know, decided to back us in that $200 million raise that we completed about 2 months ago. I mean, experience, you know, it's a lot harder than I expected going in, honestly. I started the company in a different world. It's hard to know when you're in a bit of a bubble. We were in a bubble. Shame on me. I've been in a bubble at Living.com, too, in 1998, 1999. But the experience overall has been really positive and in some ways affirming of what it feels like to work with awesome investors, whether it's Juxtapose and Hudson Structured, like in those quarters where it was still unclear our path to getting big enough, growing fast enough, like super supportive during that time frame. And then fast forward to this situation, it's been a handful of quarters that we've been working with initially Summit, now Silversmith, prior to getting the round closed. We took our time on our end to make sure that the firms we were considering working with ticked all of our boxes. And we wanted to be, despite the environment, we didn't want to lower our bar. We wanted to work only with awesome investors like our first few. And on top of that, you know, their scrutiny on us, I think fair enough, was pretty deep too. And so that's why it took some time to get there. But in our situation, we pivoted from venture-backed, having gotten to the Series A, into a pretty good size growth equity round on the strength of the unique approach that we are taking, right? It goes back to differentiation, and we've talked about that a lot here. But Summit and Silversmith readily saw that we're really different than other opportunities that are in the marketplace today, certainly around financial services and fintech companies, because of that verticalized approach. And in addition, they have to be healthcare investors, both Darren and Jeff, who we work with in those firms most closely. And so they really understood the thesis. They understood very deeply from the many hundreds and hundreds of doctors that they know and work with that they need better than what they're getting from financial services firms. So my experience centers on an idea that we took time to build trust in one another. We certainly wanted to dig as deep on them as they dug into us. But that alignment around vision, mission, like our unique purpose in the world, like why would the world be worse off if we're not there? They totally got that. And we ended up, you know, some time ago with a handshake agreement that, you know, if you guys over at EARN do X, Y, and Z, then we over here at Summit and Silversmith, they're going to come through with the right investment. And that's what happened.
That's incredible. And I mean, it's also interesting how you end up raising such a big of an amount on the second raise, especially during the times that we're in. No, I mean, how were you guys able to arrive to that number? And how were you able to like make that happen? Because I mean, right now the market is not as favorable.
Yeah, it's clearly a tough market. We worked hand in glove. The teams there, my teams, we worked hand in glove to build out the thesis on an acquisition-driven strategy go forward that would accelerate our vision to be fully comprehensive, have the capital to build up the tech and those sorts of things, extend our reach into many, many thousands of additional doctors. But working hand in glove with that team enabled us to get to know each other really well. But it also made it a natural conclusion that this opportunity is big enough that we need to put in a substantial amount of capital to make that vision a reality. And so I think those two like worked together, right? So their conviction level as high as ours. If they were on the podcast here, I think they'd say, well, this has been our thesis too. We just didn't meet a company that could sort of activate it for us. But it comes down to how much capital do you need to be able to go and build an awesome business with that strategy. Fortunately, these are like we have deep pocketed investors. They can go far higher if the situation warrants it. But we all agreed that this is the amount of capital that we needed to make the run that we're going to make over the next couple of years to get there.
So then, obviously, when investors say putting money, they believe really on a vision, right? And that's not just the investors, also, you know, the team and, you know, customers and you name it. So I guess when it comes to the vision, imagine you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world here where the vision for earned wealth is fully realized, John. What does that world look like?
Awesome. I love that. I think about that all the time, honestly. And it takes me back to May of 21, thinking about this, the same very topic. Here's what it looks like, right? So what it looks like at like point one is doctors feel far more confident that it made sense to become a doctor. And if you're young and considering the profession, you say to yourself, you know what, because of what EARN can do for me, literally what EARN can do for me, I feel like I can become a doctor, and that's going to be a good decision for me. When today, a lot of folks are regretting it. The financial stress, the financial strain is too great. You have so many people that get through med school and opt out of actually getting into clinical care because they worry about having $350K in debt and that sort of thing. So at the highest level, the profession is considered an awesome profession once more, and the best and the brightest are back going into a career as a doctor. Underneath that, what's happening to our clients? What's happening to our clients is they're feeling like their financial lives are in awesome shape. They feel the peace of mind that goes with that. They've got independence that also goes with having made the right choices with us at their side. And so they're achieving 2-3 times what they otherwise would have achieved in terms of net worth. But again, critically, they're feeling like their wealth is higher, but their well-being is higher too. They've got peace of mind about where they are in their financial lives, which can be transformative in how someone thinks about their career. So alongside, you know, clients and their outcomes, which is most important, I think in that vision, when I wake up, it's also going to be things like the very most capable, highly committed people around anything to do with finance want to come to EARN. They see that because of the unique things that we do for clients, we're the number one choice. We're the place that people want to work because of the purpose and what we're achieving for our clients. And from a brand point of view, that vision would include being considered the only place that a doctor would go around their personal life, their family's financial life, around the practice, the only place they'd ever consider going or need to go around anything to do with their financial life. Those would be the main elements, I'd say, for me on achieving a vision.
So we're talking here about the, obviously, the future. But I want to talk about the past with a lens of reflection. So let's say I was to put you into a time machine. And let's say I bring you back in time. You know, let's say maybe the late 80s, when you were completing your MBA, you know, at Harvard, and you had some friends that were going to, you know, starting their own companies and stuff like that. And let's say you had the opportunity of going back in time there. And let's say, you know, you had the opportunity to give your younger self one piece of advice as you would embark in your professional career and in your journey, you know, and that advice would be one before you were to get started, maybe with launching a company down the line. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Awesome. I think for me, that one piece of advice would be to check in like all the time around, am I loving what I'm doing? And am I highly like respectful and motivated by the purpose of this place and my colleagues and, you know, what we're doing together for clients? So I found myself in situations early career, Alejandro, where I was sort of solving for, well, I want to learn a lot. That's admirable. I want to get up, you know, quickly learn like analytics and whatever it might be, all admirable. But I traded off at some points. I mean, am I truly deeply passionate about this? And am I loving, you know, enough of everything around it for this to be highly motivating for me? And I call it out because having gone through a few turnarounds, having made a mistake or two in job choice, I can go right back to the root that the reason I made that mistake was I wasn't paying attention to those factors. And, you know, I learned later too that if those things are in place, man, I can do my best work. I'm going to show up better for my teams, my colleagues. I'll show up better for clients. I have a lot more fun doing it. I'll be better at home. if that's true too. But it, you know, early in career, I wasn't as focused on those elements. I was focused on other things. And I would definitely change that. I'm not. There's a few things I would have done differently as a consequence. That's absolutely true.
So, John, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You know, best way is probably just to drop me a note, you know, either LinkedIn, you can find me there, obviously, or john@earnedwealth.com. Happy to chat with anybody.
That's right. That's right. Well, amazing, John. Really appreciate the time here. Thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
It's been my pleasure, Alejandro. Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.